Attention, this is not legal advice. If you are experiencing a legal emergency, contact an attorney or your local public defender's office.
The views expressed by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of Gin and Justice. Justice.
Hey, I'm Justine.
And I'm Amanda.
Welcome to another episode of Gin and Justice. And for those of you who follow us closely, you know that this is supposed to be a legal brief week. Psych. However, this week we are going to skip our legal brief and bring you this full-length episode because we have issues of much importance.
Yeah, this country's fucked up, man.
So on October 10th, which was Sunday, the 19th annual World Day Against the Death Penalty, which is a day to raise awareness, advocate, all of that for the abolition of the death penalty worldwide, and to raise awareness about all of these circumstances and issues that surround the death penalty that we have covered on this show time and time again. So,
and I just want to say there is a list of people that are scheduled to be executed right now, and you can contact every single one of their governors.
Right. You just did that on behalf of
Julius Jones.
Willie Smith is another one that is coming up.
Also on deathpenalty.org, they're doing a fall webinar series. So October 15th is the first of the series, and it's the Women on Death Row webinar.
Nice.
So if you want to check that out, deathpenalty.org.
And also if you go to worldcoalition.org, they also focused on women sentenced to death, and they talk about the unique circumstances that surround women who are placed on death row. So if you guys have not picked up yet, we have had a theme. Last week, we did have Allison from Ohioans to Stop Executions. Today, we are bringing you a full-length episode from another exoneree. Remember from our episode from last week that October 19th, which is next Tuesday, is Lobby Day in Ohio. And there are legislative pieces on the table to abolish the death penalty. Ohio is hoping to become the 19th state to abolish the death penalty. So please go to nodeathpenaltyoh.com and they will have all the information there for Lobby Day. Again, that's on October 19th.
And if you haven't liked, rated, and reviewed us yet, please do that.
Follow us on all the socials. If you screenshot a review, email it to Amanda@ginandjusticepodcast.com. We will send you some free Gin and Justice merch. Also, I do want to bring attention. If you guys recall our episode where we interviewed Sandra and we talked about her and her brother James. James is serving a 30-year sentence in federal prison for a non-violent drug offense, which is bull. He is looking for a pen pal and someone just to write back and forth with. They do need moral support. We want to support people through their periods of incarceration.
So we will put his address in our show notes.
Correct. We'll put his inmate number and his address, and please reach out to James. He is a nice guy, and so is his sister Sandra. She is doing everything she can to help fight against her brother's 30-year nonviolent drug offense in the federal system.
So this week's interview is another death row exoneree from Witness to Innocence.
From Florida, again.
Witnesstoinnocence.org.
Yes, and we'll put that in our show notes as well. They are an organization that we have worked with before. If you guys remember the Juan Melendez episode, Witness to Innocence is an organization that helps death row exonerees basically tell their stories and kind of raise awareness about the issues surrounding death row.
And advocating to abolish the death penalty.
Correct. We just can't continue to get this wrong. There was just another, we talked about it last week, there was another death row exoneree, Sherwood Brown. He's been in prison since 1996, I believe it was. So, again, guys, just doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense financially. It doesn't make sense
morally.
It doesn't make sense to deter crime. There's no criminology study that has ever indicated that deterrence is ever an effective method of reducing crime. It does not make our communities safer. So,
and this gentleman's story
just shows you how honestly easy it can be easy to put on death row.
It's insane.
To be falsely convicted. Yeah, it's crazy.
And he was very raw and emotional and honest with us, which we can't appreciate more.
Guys, it does take a lot of courage for these guys to come on and share their story, whether they're an exoneree, whether they're someone helping to fight against their brother's mandatory sentence, whether it's somebody who is working to get bills passed, whether it's somebody who is working to represent us. You know, it takes courage to come on here and share, so we always want to thank our guests.
So enjoy this interview with Joaquin, a.k.a. Joe Martinez.
We have the pleasure of interviewing Joaquin Martinez, and you go by Joe?
Joe, yes.
Perfect. All right.
It's a lot easier.
Tell us about yourself, Joe.
I think it's easier for everyone, you know, Joaquin. Some Joaquin, I've been called everything, so. It's an honor to be here
with you.
Tell
us about yourself.
Well,
thank you.
It's amazing. I just turned 20 years since my release, June 6, 2001. This past week, so I'm quite excited. I can't stop celebrating these past few days with the family. It's just been an amazing trip these past 20 years. So many things I've done, so many people I've met, and it's just a wonderful experience. And it's just, you know, back then when I was on death row, I never thought that this day would come, that we'd make it this far. And it's just great. You know, if I started to enumerate every single thing that I've been through. I mean, so many experiences, love, emotions, children. You know, I have two beautiful 7-year-old kids. They're going to be 8 at the end of this month. I have an 8-year-old born in the States. I went into death row with 2 kids, and I now have 7. And I'm my grandfather to 3, so, you know, 3 grandchildren, you know. You know, it's just I owe it all to the people that have been by my side, you know, and the organizations that have worked with me, like WTI, they've been great. And it's just great to be alive. It's just great to be here.
Thank you for sharing. And so for our listeners, you're with Witness to Innocence, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I work with different organizations. I'm out here in Europe. I'm in Spain right now. And I do work with Witness to Innocence, but you know, I look at Witness to Innocence almost like a family. You know, I hate to say the words work with, you know, because they I consider them my family. They've guided me since I was released in the right direction with peer groups, with a lot of support that death row inmates need when they're released from death row. You know, it's not just about going back home. It's not easy to go back home, you know,
right.
And especially with, you know, with cases with years and years of being on death row, when they're finally released, you know, they have to learn how to do everything from scratch. You know, I'm fortunate. It's funny to say that I'm fortunate. I only spent 3 years on death row, and I can't imagine spending 15, 20 years like other friends of mine have spent. You know, I can't imagine what they've gone through, but I know that with the 3 years that I've had on death row, that was just almost like a lifetime. And coming back out to society was quite difficult. You know, I have to be honest, you know, maybe we should start from the beginning and be quite clear with everyone. You know, I used to believe in the death penalty. I was a very strong supporter of the death penalty. You know, you have to realize that back then, the death penalty was in question. You know, it was the law, period. You know, to say no to the death penalty was almost like, you know, anti-American, you know, saying no to the law itself. So it wasn't like it is today, where you have a debate, where you actually have people considering changing the law and making things better. We didn't have that back then, you know, and I was a law-abiding citizen. You know, I grew up as an American, Pledge of Allegiance, you know, and I grew up in Catholic school, and you know, I loved sports. Although I was European, I grew up as just another American, taxpaying American that believed in the American dream, you know, and I think in some ways I was able to accomplish that American dream. At the age of 24, when I was arrested, I had already been married and divorced, which is not part of the American dream, but it seems like it's something common, you know. I had my two beautiful daughters. I had my own business, my house on the beach, my sports car. So I pretty much had everything that I could possibly want, you know. And I recall back then, you know, when this whole thing about the death penalty was starting to pick up, you know, about this movement, anti-death penalty, you know, I used to think to myself, wow, you know, these people, don't they have anything better to do? You know, I mean, they're out here rioting against the death penalty. They're going to execute a guy, you know, that's been on death row 20 years of my taxpaying money. Wow, don't they have anything better to do? You know, and you know, in many ways, I'm glad they didn't listen to anything I had to say, because years later, these same people, a lot of groups and a lot of people backed me up and helped me to get out of death row. You know.
Wow. Yeah. So you said you came from Europe.
Yeah.
Where did
you? I'm a Spanish citizen. I became the first European to be released from death row, and the first Spaniard to enter death penalty after the regime of Franco. So it was a big, you know, boom here in Spain. You know, when I was arrested and when I went through the whole trial and process, you know. No one here believed that I would end up on death row, you know. Not even I believed that. And not even the media in the States and Florida that were covering the case thought I would end up on death row. Unfortunately, it happened that way, you know. It was a very cruel, heinous crime. Two people have been murdered the way that they have been murdered. And according to the law, which is what we believe in, which is what we follow, the person of persons responsible for this crime deserved the death penalty. I mean, the woman was, she was butchered. I mean, she received over 30 stab wounds throughout the back, stabbed in the head. Her boyfriend was shot to death with 9 impact wounds, bullet wounds. But I mean, the way this couple, you know, was murdered, you know, deserved the death penalty. You know, there was a big outcry for justice when all this occurred. I was very stupid at that time in my life. I was 24, and I, you know, I was living this American dream, this VIP, you know, standard of living. Thought that, you know, I thought I was on top of everything. You know, I had another way of life. I wasn't a great father, I must admit. I wasn't a great husband, and I wasn't a great person. I was very arrogant, very stupid. You know, I'm not proud of saying all these things, but it's the way it was. It's the way I was, you know. And I think the biggest mistake, you know, the biggest mistake for my part with this whole trial and leading up to death row was hiring my personal attorney, my divorce attorney, my business attorney, my traffic ticket attorney. You know, I really thought that you know, believing in the system and believing that I was innocent was enough. I really didn't find the need, and I could have, you know, to get the best attorney, if not in the city in Florida, you know. I didn't find that need. I thought, hey, I got this covered. I got a good attorney. I'm innocent, you know, and it doesn't work that way. You know, when I arrived on death row, obviously, I never expected to end up there. I lost all hope in everyone. I lost hope in the law and the process, the system. I felt betrayed by the system I had supported all my life. You know,
you were betrayed by the system.
You know, and it hurt to look at it. It hurt to see it. It hurt to form a part of it and to see myself there on death row, sentenced to death. And you know, the only thought in my mind, to be honest with you, the day that door actually closes and I'm inside the cell, the first day, the first moment, the only thought was like, wow, you know. They've really sentenced me to death. They've sent me to death row. They are going to kill me. You know, my whole world came crashing down that day. I lost my faith in God. I had already lost my faith in friends. My VIP friends, the ones that would always be there everywhere you go, they weren't there. I was alone. It was just my parents and I. And that's when things began to change. And I guess I realized and I made some changes in my life as well. You know, all that arrogance, all that ignorance went away. I became a new person, completely on death row. 20 years. Wow, you know, it's amazing. You know, look back and say,
wow. Yeah, time passes quickly. And do you remember when you were arrested and how you kind of felt that day?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. The day that I got arrested, I really thought that, you know, that nothing was going to happen. You know, I'll be clear with you. The day I got arrested was Super Bowl Sunday. I laugh now, you know, because when all this happens to me back then, you know, it's crazy because I get arrested January 27th, 1996. My girlfriend back then, the reason why I went through my divorce and everything else, her birthday was the day before, and we had celebrated her birthday at Disney, and I had told my ex-wife a small lie. I told her that I was working that day and I wasn't going to see my daughters that day. I would, instead of Saturday, I would go Sunday before the big game. And she said, she said, you, Saturday, work. I went to Disney. You know, like, once again, I wasn't the perfect father. Not at all, you know, back then.
You were a really young father, too.
I was very stupid as well, you know.
Don't worry, our parents all do stuff to, no one's a perfect parent.
I try to be though now, you know, but I remember that day, what made it so particular was that it was her birthday, and I told my ex-wife, listen, Sloan, I can't come see the children today. I have to go to work. She calls my job and she finds out I'm celebrating with my fiance at Disney. Gets angry and runs out and calls the number on one of the flyers that they've put around the city for information leading up to the arrest of the person or persons responsible for this double homicide. There's a phone number. She reaches out to them and she tells them, she doesn't tell them that I committed the crime. She says, it's possible that my ex-husband has something to do with this crime. They come out to her home. I'm not aware of any of this. You know, Super Bowl Sunday the next day. The only thing I remember is showing up at the house, terrible hangover, to see my daughters. You know, once again, not doing too well. And you know, she kept talking to me about this double homicide that had taken place. And I kept saying I didn't know what she was talking about. I heard about it in the news, papers, etc. But she kept making reference to it, and one, you know, came to a point where it's just had enough of it. I went out of the house, you know, and got in the car, and when I had reached to the stop sign, you know, I laugh now because, you know, I look back at all these things happening. You know, I watch movies, and you know, and people say you got to watch this movie. It's about death row, and it's about this guy that's innocent, you know. And I watch all these movies, you know. And back then, I felt like I was in a movie because the minute I got to the stop sign, I saw a car cut me off from the left, another one from the right. I look at the rearview mirror and I see two cars from behind me, you know, and I hear the screeching of on the wheels, you know, and I have this terrible headache, terrible hangover from drinking the night before. I'm looking up, I see a helicopter, I'm seeing all these things happen, you know, and the only thing that comes to my mind was, wow, you know, they're having a big Super Bowl party around here today, you know. You know, just it's so unreal, you know, unreal what I'm living at that moment, you know. And they arrest me. I mean, they arrest me in front of my kids. You know, they take me out of the car, they pull me out of the car, they throw me on the floor, on the ground, my face to the pavement, their knee on my back, and here I am watching my daughters cry, watching me get arrested, you know. They take me to a station. And here I am, here's the ignorant, the stupid Joe, the arrogant. The only thing I could say to the police once I get there, I said to them, out of the few things I remember, I said to them, can we make this quick so I can go home and watch the game? You know? And the police, you know, they're just looking at me and they're saying, we need your, you know, corroboration. We've heard you, your confession. Now we want you to write it down. They throw these cassette tapes at me. Then they give me these papers, you know, pen, and they say, we need to write down your confession and everything that you've said to your ex-wife at her home, and we, you know, we need you to sign it. And I said, confession, you know, I said, I haven't confessed to anything. He said, yeah, we've heard you confess. Now we want you to write it down. And, you know, when I started seeing all this and you know, knowing that, seeing that there was something not right, I finally said, I want to talk to my attorney. I can't proceed with this because it didn't look too good. really didn't. You know, and at that moment, I called my attorney, Mr. Don't Worry. Growing up as an American, those are the words I've heard the most. Don't worry. He would always say don't worry to me. That he would take care of all the problems and everything would go away. But when I called him, I said, Tom, I got this problem. I've been arrested for a double homicide, two people that were murdered. And these people are saying that I know something about it or that I've confessed to it. I need you to come down to the station, get me out of here so I can get home in time to watch the game and go on. You know, I think this has to be something else, another call from my ex-wife. It wasn't the first time she had called. I really don't want to go into more details, you know, but he said, yeah, don't worry, Joe. You know, I got you. And he says he couldn't come that day. It was Sunday. That he would be there Monday. And Monday came around, and he came, and you know, he said that they had me taped, confessed on a tape, and all these things. And I said, wow, you know, okay, where do we start? I want to hear the tapes where I confess. He said, well, there's a problem with the tapes. They're inaudible.
So they don't have tapes.
That's the first thing, you know, that makes me go crazy. I said, what? You know, inaudible. I mean, what happened? And he explains to me that they went to her home, my ex-wife's home, the day before on Saturday after the phone call in the afternoon. They prepared all the mics. They had a surveillance van outside. They had the police. You know, I'm inside the home listening to police cars everywhere in the city, and I'm thinking, wow, this is big today, you know. And, you know, they have like three or four mics. And all of a sudden they say to me that the tapes are inaudible, that they cannot be heard properly. And they say, okay, so what do we do now? And they say, well, we're going to send them to the FBI laboratory. I said, great. You know, what's that, a day or two or a week? Or, you know, and they answered about a month later. And the FBI said they couldn't get anything done with the tapes either. And they recommended that the state attorney, my ex-wife, and everyone that had heard the supposed confession, drop a transcript of my confession that day. And they did that. They drew up a transcript with the help of the victim's father, who was the head of the evidence department, sheriff's office in Tampa. So,
I'm sorry, the murder victim's father?
Yeah.
Wrote up the transcript of the tape?
Yeah. Yeah, that came up on the second trial and, you know, helped a lot.
Wow.
But these are things
our
that...
Our listeners cannot see our faces right now, but...
These are things that we, you know, there, so many things occur, you know, when you try to get, and I can understand, you know, I can't justify what they did to me, but I can understand the need to close this case as soon as possible. Not only was the victim's father head of the evidence department in the sheriff's office, his son, the victim, was a drug dealer. So as you can imagine, there was a big outcry to close this case up, more importantly, because of social opinion. I mean, you can imagine what was coming down on them. This comes out of the second trial, obviously, and we were able to take care of it.
So they ultimately got these transcripts brought into trial somehow.
Yes, they were. They allowed the transcripts to be used at trial. The judge permitted it because of the recommendation from the FBI laboratory. The FBI laboratory said, we can't do anything with the recordings, so, you know, your best bet is to get a transcript drawn up by the people that heard the confession and the conversation that was taking place. And they got everyone to work on these transcripts, including the victim's father and the victim's cousins, who also worked for the police department. So it was quite, you know, challenging. You know, challenging is not the word. And you
so
know,
this didn't come out during your first trial.
No, not at all. Not at all. We weren't. You know, it's difficult to say. You know, but to have a good attorney team, a good team of professionals working together, is very important for these type of cases. You know, I didn't think it would be necessary when innocence was the main factor. But, you know, in these type of cases, it doesn't really matter. You know, innocence is the least important factor for you to win a trial of this magnitude. You know, but it is important to get a good team of attorneys to be able to bring out this information. Honestly, and to be to let y'all know, who brought this to our attention was the prosecutor, the second prosecutor that tried the case, was the same person, the same man that let us know that these documents existed, they were shown to my attorney at that time, Peter Rabin. And Peter Rabin immediately made a copy of everything, all the documentation, and obviously, as you can imagine, right before the second trial, you know, the victim's father was questioned during the deposition as to, you know, his involvement in this transcript, and he denied it until the very end when the attorneys showed him the transcripts with his written notes and signature at the very bottom. Not only his, but also the victim's cousins and family members and other people that had done whatever they wanted with this transcript. He would have been a very positive, I'm referring to the victim's father, he would have been a very positive witness to the defense. Unfortunately, he passed away. He got a heart attack right before my second trial. So we weren't able to use that information. When it came down to it, it wasn't really necessary either, you know.
Right.
So, believe me, if you're shocked, you can't imagine how I was when all this came out.
Right, and you were so young too.
It was very, you know, I was so caught up in everything that when I arrived in death row, I just couldn't stop questioning why I had arrived in death row, what I was doing there with surrounded by killers and people that I had questioned all my life, you know. You know, I guess everything has a reason, you know. These supposed killers that I, you know, these monsters that I had once referred to them as, became quite good friends, you know, became my family. So, you know, but the recordings wasn't the what really got me, you know, what really really just made me question the whole system itself was the DNA. The DNA evidence was just overwhelming at the scene. They found blood, hair samples, saliva that didn't belong to the victims, under the female victims' fingernails. They found skin samples, blood, lots of fibers that didn't belong to the victims. And obviously they asked me to do DNA testing, you know, and I agreed, you know. And we did all the DNA testing. They tested not only the car, you know, that I drove, you know, and so many other things, but you know, I really thought that with that, I would be able to go home. You know, the DNA was starting to clear people from other crimes, and I thought, well, this will be great, you know. But when we got to the trial, well, not the trial, but the pre-trial, the state attorney says, you know, the DNA is negative, but that doesn't mean anything. You know, that only means that Mr. Martinez was there with other people or person that committed the crime.
Even though none of your DNA was found there?
No DNA at the scene of the crime. They left the DNA, but Mr. Martinez was there with them. And it didn't matter what. I mean, it came down to a point. Let me be honest with you. I was accused of having committed this murder on a Friday afternoon, when in fact the victims had spoken to their family, even received a visit from the mom that followed that same Saturday evening. You know, it didn't matter. I would bring that up at trial, and the prosecutor, which was reprimanded by the Supreme Court when they reached them on appeal, the prosecutor's words were the following. It doesn't matter if Mr. Martinez killed them on a Friday, on a Saturday, a Sunday, or a Monday. The fact is that he killed them. And of course, the Supreme Court got a hold of that transcript and wasn't too happy with the statement from the prosecutor, my first prosecutor, who was completely different than my second prosecutor. Honestly, it was a big difference. That all led me to death row. That, my ex-wife's testimony, jailhouse informant.
Has she ever been charged with a crime?
No. I think, honestly.
Did she have any consequences?
No, none at all. Honestly, I don't believe she her. I don't believe she wanted to send me to death row. Really, I think we were going through a very difficult custody battle over my daughters. We were going through some typical divorce issues, and I really thought that it was just another phone call to the authorities. You know, I mean, she had called previously the authorities saying that I wanted to take my kids to Europe. You know, and all these other things, you know. And she didn't realize how serious this was. If I didn't realize how serious this whole thing was until I arrived on death row, I can imagine her, you know. I thought this was a walk in the park, really. I really thought that with my attorney being innocent, no evidence whatsoever, I would be able to go home. I mean, they went as far as to even, when it came down to ballistics, I used to go target shooting with my brother. I have family in the military out in the States. My brother's in the military, and we would on the weekends go with target practice. You know, I had 2 9mm guns registered, and they did ballistic. They tried them out, and it didn't matter. You know, no matter what you said, because they were the same type of caliber used at the scene, 9mm. It was negative, but that, you know, according to them, that doesn't mean anything. That just meant that, you know, he knew how to shoot a 9mm gun, you know, so it really didn't matter what I said. And I didn't think a trial could take that place, you know, could take place that way. I mean, never in a million years did I imagine I would end up on death row, really. I'm baffled, you know, about everything that happened.
Yeah, it seems like they had a target on you and just kind of did one of those cases where they just configured the story around whatever they had, yeah, and not really try to figure out what or who actually did it.
Yeah, well, you know what happens, not only in the States, but everywhere in the world, once you come out publicly saying we have the persons responsible for a certain crime or the person responsible, no one wants to go back and say, "Oof, we made a mistake." You know, no one ever says that. You know, in my case, once they go forward and they say we have who we think committed this murder, they went ahead with it and built a case, a non-existing case on a person. It could have been me. It could have been someone else. Fortunate for that someone else, you know, it was me, because I was able to get the support I received, the attorneys I had, and everything I had to be able to get a new trial. Without that support, I would be dead today. I wouldn't be free. I wouldn't be on death row waiting to be executed. I'd probably be dead right now. I was accused of killing the son of a sheriff officer, of a head of the evidence department. You know, I mean, you know, it's crazy.
Did you get a new trial on direct appeal, or did you have to file a habeas or a writ?
Okay, I'll be clear with you. I'll run down the 3-year stay on death row the following way. You know, as soon as I get arrested, I let everything in my parents' hands. You know, I say, "Mom, Dad, take care of this. I've messed up. You know, I've effed up big time. I shouldn't have trusted my attorney. I should have listened to what you were saying. You know, because they kept saying to me, get an attorney, get a trial attorney that knows how to handle these type of cases. Don't get your personal attorney." And I said to them, "From now on, do things your way." So my parents went crazy, all out, getting European help here in Europe, not only from the Spanish government, but from the European Parliament, the Italian Senate, the government parties, the King of Spain. I mean, even Pope John Paul II, you know, I mean, so much support to be able to get a good team of attorneys to prepare a brief, an appeal, an initial appeal. And they did this. They were able to get support. They were able to get money, and we were able to get a good team of attorneys. This lasted 1 year during my stay in death row. My second year, the attorneys that she hired, or the attorney in this case, spent preparing the brief. It was a direct appeal brief, and the Supreme Court took 3 months, which almost record time, to debate and decide to grant me a new trial. 3 months is a very short time. They granted me a unanimous new trial, basically forcing them to forcing the state to do things differently, do things in the correct manner, and try this case in the way it should be tried. I would say I was very fortunate to have a good attorney, to get a good, you know, but these things cost money, you know. No one understands that, you know, that if I would have been anyone else, if I would have been any other minority, any other, you know, person, you know, going through all this, I wouldn't have gotten a new trial, and I would have been executed, innocent. I mean, that's just the least, you know. You know, that doesn't matter anything when it comes down to these things, you know. I was very fortunate to have all the support I received, from my parents to the media groups to European countries that helped me out to, you know, and the attorneys, obviously. I mean, without a good team of attorneys, I would have been lost. You know? So I got that new trial on that third year, and a little bit later came down to Tampa again and got a new trial, you know, and began the process, you know. And the process had changed so much. I mean, y'all can't imagine how same courtroom, same judge, different prosecutor, different attorney. We went through so many things. I mean, so many different meetings, these special meetings that they have with the judge, you know, where they were debating what to, and we got smart. We got very smart. We contracted an ex-FBI lab worker, very good one, in fact, to be able to listen to the tapes and try to work on them and get them enhanced, you know. And these tapes were enhanced. And I can't really give too many details on this, but I know that they had a private meeting with this lab guy, the FBI lab guy, and the judge. And when the judge came out of this meeting, basically throughout the recording, basically throughout the transcripts, and was very, very angry with the police department and told them that if they wanted to say anything, if they were going to testify against me, that they will have to use their notes from that day. He wasn't too happy with, obviously, what he had heard on the enhanced tapes, yeah. Which I know, I mean, without going into detail, I know had nothing to do with murdering these two people, you know, it was other things, not even murder. It was, you know, things that had to do with my ex-wife and my continuous, you know, way of not being a good husband and things that I used to do back then, you know, things I'm not proud of. So they threw out the tapes, that second trial. The first day I went to trial, they didn't even seek the death penalty. I mean, this is like, wow, you know, this is big. Because for a case like this, you need to seek the death penalty. You need to it's a case where it's cruel, it's heinous, it's atrocious. Two people have been murdered, a woman has been stabbed multiple times. This deserves a death penalty. And here they were telling the victim's family and my family as well that they were no longer seeking the death penalty. It was a big surprise to the defense, but it helped. It was amazing, you know, that they didn't seek the death penalty the first day. Then they threw out the tapes, and then there was even other things that occurred, you know. Everything was just coming out and turning out the right way, you know, the way a trial should be, you know. I was fortunate once again to have the support I received. Without the support, I'd be dead today, really.
So on your first trial compared to your second trial, and you say it was very different from your first trial.
Yeah.
Did you feel like maybe that target on you was not necessarily there anymore?
Yeah. I think in some ways, I mean, I had words with the judge after the second trial, obviously. He was the same judge for the first trial. And I recalled, I said to him, as soon as the first trial ended, he says, do you have anything to say? And I said to him, I'll be back. And it's all written down, you know, I'll be back in front of you, I'll be back in this courtroom, and I will be able to prove my innocence, you know. And you know, he looked at me, you know, nodded his head, you know, and there it was, close to five and a half years later, you know, 4.5 later, in front of him, you know, and he was really, I think he was as surprised as I was that everything had taken place the way it had taken place. I should have never gone to death row, you know, but it was necessary for the system, you know, for the system to prove that it doesn't commit any mistakes, and for the system to bring tranquility, you know, to the homes of so many people in society, you know, that they actually thought, well, we have a criminal locked up, you know, when in reality that, you know, the person or persons responsible for this crime were, you know, they're still out there, you know. You think about it, you say, wow, you know. Yeah. But I guess I always try to, you know what, I have it's part of me now since I've been released from death row and all my experience on death row, everything I went through. I try to justify what everyone does, you know, even the authorities, even the police, even the judge, you know. And I guess in some ways that's what makes me a new person, a different person, you know. If the death row has done anything for me, believe me when I say this, it's changed me completely. It's humbled me more than anyone can imagine. You know, it's this rich, pretty boy going around the the VIP places, eating dinners here and there, and very arrogant, very stupid with the people, and ending up on death row, you know, wearing the same orange suit, you know, for 5.5 years, you know, wow, you know, it's, you know, it wasn't, you know, you didn't have that Armani to choose, or, you know, to see up, you know, is it raining? Do I wear the black suit, the dark suit, the light suit, you know, or even the food, you know, it's just eat from a plastic spoon. I mean, wow, I don't want anyone to feel sorry for me, you know, but when I arrived on death row, here was with a platter, with a plate, you know, with the food that they serve, and then with a plastic spoon, you know, so used to having all the silverware in front of me, cups, and complaining to the waiter or waitress, you know, saying, wow, change this cup, change, you know, it was just a humbling experience, really. I mean, whatever, you know, I say this now, you know, but when I was released, I used to cry over everything, you know, I mean, when the first thing, when the first dinner that I had at the Spanish embassy with the Spanish consulate and other people from the ministry, we were all sitting down with my parents and everything. And, you know, and I see all these silverware, you know, like in the past, and I started to cry. And they said, what is wrong? I said, I haven't had this in over 5.5 years, you know. And then all of a sudden, I see the consulate come out with the person that was cooking the dinner. And the consulate says to me, Joaquin, what do you want to eat? You know, and more tears, you know, I'm saying, wow, you know, after 5.5 years, they're asking me what I want to eat, you know, wow, this is big, you know, this is big. You know, it humbled me in such a way where I appreciated every little thing that I have now. I mean, y'all can't imagine how my life's been these past 20 years. It hasn't been perfect. I lost my father 2 years after I was released. You know, there's something I didn't mention. I try not to, you know, but even when I arrived on death row, I still believed in the death penalty. I didn't believe in the system that led me up to the death penalty, but I continued to believe in the death penalty, you know. And there was a guy on death row who, you know, really changed my mentality towards it. An innocent man who was Frank Lee Smith, who was accused of murder and rape of a 9-year-old girl. You know, this man had no love, you know. When I say no love, I mean he had no love from no one, from the guards, from no one there, just us, you know, the guys that were there with him, you know. 19 years, he had lost his mind. He'd get up in the middle of the night screaming, saying, get me out of here, I'm innocent. Do this damn DNA test on me, get the DNA done. They didn't do it. You know, he died of cancer on death row. Last time I saw him, he was handcuffed to a gurney, hospital bed, lost a lot of weight. He was dying of cancer. And, you know, they didn't do the testing until a year after, you know, they discovered that he was innocent, you know, after he's dead, after he dies of cancer on death row, you know. And that's what really changes my life towards, and my mentality towards death penalty, that it wasn't just me that was on death row, it wasn't just Joaquin, you know. Luckily, I'm able to speak, you know, I'm here today, you know. But all those people that I ran across on death row, most of them, they passed away, you know. It's difficult, you know, and here I am, and I'm coming back home, and I'm speaking about this experience to so many people going everywhere, going across Europe, and you know, and there was this one question that kept coming up always, you know, is the same question. I didn't know how to, I mean, after everything I had been through, there was just one thing I couldn't answer. It was the question, you know, I guess I could summarize it in Sicily, in Catania, that an auditorium, but you. Students and buses coming, you know, to see me, hear me speak, you know, about my experience on death row. At the very end, this young girl, 17-year-old, gets up at the back, and she says, Joaquin, you know, I have a question for you. And I said, what? You know, he said, well, you know, you're on death, you know, you're against the death penalty because you went to death row. I said, yeah, maybe. He said, well, and then she begins to speak to me and tells me a story about her father, how her father was killed in the, you know, because of the mafia. Sicily, how he was killed right in front of her. And with tears in her eyes, she makes this question to me. She asks me, she says to me, how would you feel, what would you say, what would you do if someone killed one of your daughters, one of your, you know, one of your brothers or your father, your mother, you know? And I had no answer for her, you know. 2 years after my release, my father was killed by a 17-year-old on a motorbike. I went to the hospital, didn't know he was dead. My mom was there, and I recall that I'm you know, speaking to her, and the doctor says, "Come with me," and they show me my dad, and they show me that he's dead. You know the ideas that people have nowadays when they see something on TV so atrocious, so cruel, that they say, "Wow, that person deserves the death penalty." You know, that those feelings of rage, vengeance that come about when you see something horrible happen, especially to kids, you know, to children, you know, you say, "Wow, you know, that person," you know, I felt all that rage. You know, I don't justify that way of thinking, but when that doctor told me that my father was killed because of a 17-year-old on a motorbike, on a motorcycle, speeding, I went crazy. I went. I didn't know what, you know, how to react, what to do. My mom's with tears in her eyes, crying. She shakes me real hard, you know, and she tells me in Spanish, you know, and she says to me, "No has aprendido nada. Have you not learned anything?" You know, and you know, I think the hardest thing that I've had to do in my life. And I've been through so many things y'all can't imagine. I mean, I could go on for hours. Was to forgive this 17-year-old. I forgive him for three reasons. I guess the first one was because mom, you know, mothers for me are God's greatest gift. You know, I get this way because I just lost my mom this past November, so it's been very, very emotional trip these past 20 years, you know? And
yeah.
I forgive him because, one, she asked me to. Two, I remember what it was like to be 17, how I was going through life. I didn't have a motorcycle. I had a motorcycle, a sports car. I was going crazy, you know? That could have been me, hitting someone on the street the way I used to go, how I was, many times drugged, drunk. And then the third main reason was the reason why I had believed in the death penalty all my life. You know, I really thought that if someone did something to my little girls, really, believe me when I say this, I would want the worst possible punishment upon the person or persons that did something to my little girls, you know? And, you know, I look back now at all this and I think to myself, I could see that 17-year-old before me standing here today. It's been over, you know, almost 20 years now. I can see a 17-year-old killed, electric chair, lethal injection, hanging, you name it, you know. Nothing could take away the pain that I feel for having lost my dad. It's been 20 years. I still miss him. So I guess that's the lesson that I've learned. You know, about to turn 50 now. I guess the main lesson and the reason why I speak out against the death penalty is because of what it represents. The lack of compassion, hatred, vengeance. You know, there's no need for that. You know, that's why I speak out against it. You know, because everything that we've seen, everything that I've lived with Frank Smith on death row, you know, family, everything I've seen afterwards, I've been, like I said, through so many ups and downs. But I've learned through every single one of them. And I try to be a better person. What I was and what I am today, wow, you know, wow, you can't imagine. I mean, I went in with two little girls to death row, and now have five more kids. Mm-hmm. You know? My last two are twins. They're seven. They drive me crazy, but I love them to death, you know. And that's my life now. I live each moment like it's my last. I enjoy every second of my life. I actually, in the beginning, I said to you both, can we do this as a casual talk? You know, because I feel more comfortable, you know, speaking to you as, you know, not as an interview, you know, because I've had millions of, but when I talk, I like to be able to express what I feel and not, you know, be so close, you know. And this is what it's about. It's about laughing. It's about crying. crying. It's about feeling, loving, and it's about living, like I said, each day, each experience, each second of my life like it's my last. I'm thankful for it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that, you know, we know, and then a lot of people we've spoken to, it seems, have gone through trauma and tragedies. And the one thing we kind of all have in common is that we learn from it, you know, whether it was caused by us or not caused by us, and we move forward and, you know, we get messages out there. So,
yeah, you telling your story is going to help change the mind of somebody that also believes in the death penalty.
I hope so. I really hope so. Like I said, it hasn't been easy for me, you know, but I make the most of it. You know, I make the best of my life, and believe it when I say I live my life to the fullest, to the very end, enjoying my life with my kids, and it's crazy. This time that I've been speaking to you, it's so important to me, you know, that people can hear this message, that I cannot stop talking against the death penalty, you know. I don't want no one to ever say, you know, Joaquin Jose, no, you know, I want to be the voice of, you know, of those that can't speak, you know, people like Frank Smith that we've left behind, you know.
It's been a pleasure meeting you, and we're so thankful you shared your story with us. It's very inspiring. Obviously, things that happen were not under your control, and it's, I mean, as you were telling your story, I'm like, this is unbelievable.
Yeah, I let me tell you something. If I was to tell anyone everything that I've been through, you know, there's just so many things, you know, and I lost my faith on death row, and I gained it later. You know, there's a big force out there. It doesn't matter what religion you believe in, who you know, there's something out there that works, you know.
Some greater power.
Yeah, there's something out there
to get this message out.
Yeah. You got to believe that. Really, you really have to believe that. To get the strength that I have to be here today, believe me, there's just so many things. Just to close up, you know, one of the most difficult things that I've had to live, apart from losing my dad, obviously my mom this past year in 3 months to cancer. You know, I have two twins that were born ahead of time. And on three occasions, they said to me and my wife at the hospital, say bye to him. He won't make it past this weekend. You know, he's 7 years old. You know, he's 70. He's still there. He's had his heart surgery, three heart surgeries later. He's living a normal life. You have to have faith. It's very important. It's not everything, but it's a very important part. You know, faith is fundamental. You know, and I realize that now. You know, and this is not just another, you know, former death row inmate talking about faith and religion. No, this is someone that's really lived some dramatic experiences that if it wasn't for faith, wouldn't have made it through any of them. You know, I really thank you guys for doing this today. You know, for having me with you, and for getting this message over to others, you know, so that they can see, you know. I wish, you know, I would have been against the death penalty, you know. Maybe I wouldn't have had the thoughts that I had, you know. Maybe, you know, I wish someone would have come to me when I was young and said, Joaquin, wake up, you know, death penalty, you know, serves no purpose. I didn't have anyone. I didn't have a Joaquin Jose Martinez, you know, podcast to listen to, you know. You know.
And, yeah, I mean, I feel like so many things happen that are out of our control in life. And so, like you're saying, you just kind of have to learn to let go of the things that are out of your control, and then just believe that things are on the right path, even if we don't know what that is.
I fully agree with you. We gotta let go. We really gotta let go sometimes. Do our part, do our best, obviously. You know, when I got to death row, I didn't just sit back and say, well, okay, let my parents and God take it. No, I gotta do my part as well. But you really gotta believe. And be you. Like I said, it was an amazing experience, everything that I went through on death row, a learning experience that's really changed me, you know, made me a better person, I think, to this day.
Yeah, I'm absolutely sure of that. We just want to thank you for your time, and thank you for sharing your story. And we look forward to staying connected with you. Please. And Witness to Innocence.
I love you. I love them. They need them. I need them in my life because since I've been released, they're the ones that keep me focused, centered, mm-hmm. you know, and they're there. They're my friends, and I'm glad I'm with them, and I'm glad to be able here to be with you. You're both here today and speak to you about, you know, people say, do you get any psychological treatment? Or I said, no, you know, no. I just speaking to the people I speak to on my everyday, today it's been you, you know, makes me go back, look back, thank God for what I have today. Really, there's nothing else.
You're helping change the world with this story.
Thank you.
All editing for Gin and Justice done by Gin and Justice Podcast.
Artwork by Justin Cardone. Photography by Kimber Schwakey.
We'll see you next time on Gin and Justice.